Uh-huh.
Stan looked at him a moment, pictured him eating alone in a big empty house somewhere, cutlery rapping gently against the plate. He could have been looking in a mirror. The woman in the denim cutoffs offered Stan a strange little smile. He returned it.
Most people just don't want to hear about it, and who could blame them?
He said.
We're a pretty depressing bunch.
A little laughter from the group.
They say things like, everything happens for a reason, and you just have to be strong. And, oh, my personal favorite, God just needed another angel. It's all code, of course, for get over it.
Sharing had strange powers. No matter how much or how little Stan was prepared to tell the group, things slipped out from some deep truth place. Usually he didn't know they were even there until he was talking about them. That night, bubbling up from that truth place, came this.
Do you ever wonder what it would be like to stop obsessing about healing and just accept this as your new reality? To stop asking what's next and start saying, this'll do.
He paused to digest his own words.
Or maybe I'm just scared to stop grieving, he said.
The truth well gurgled, then added,
because I don't remember who I was before.
There was no murmur of agreement in the group now. Maybe they couldn't relate, or maybe he'd cut too close to the bone.
That's all I got tonight, he said.
Harold Dahlgren, the group facilitator, sat forward in his seat. Dahlgren was a tall, slim man with a bright blue shirt tucked into cargo shorts. His son was shot and killed in the war in Afghanistan.
Thank you for sharing, Stan, he said. You brought up an interesting point. How can we get back to a normal life when there is no normal life without our loved ones in it?
Dahlgren went around the circle and made eye contact with each person as he talked.
You know, I was in a marching band in high school. Yep, I was one of those kids. I played the trumpet. I had the whole getup, too. The gloves, the big hat, the tunic with those weird little shoulder cords.
A few people in the group chuckled. Stan looked over at the woman in the denim cutoffs. She was looking in his direction. When he met her eye, she looked away.
I was pretty good at it, too,
Dahlgren continued.
But every now and then I'd forget the double step or play a screwy note and I'd fall out of sync with the rest of the band. It happened to everyone. Most kids took a breath and just stepped back in line. But for me, it was near impossible to find the rhythm after I'd lost it. Lately I've been thinking that's a pretty good metaphor for what we're all going through.
He looked directly at Stan.
Grief rips you out of the line, and everyone else just keeps marching on.
How do you find your rhythm again?
Stan asked him.
Sometimes you don't, he said.
Sometimes
you just need to find a new song.
Through the open doors at the back, Stan could see thunderheads rolling in over Milden. A summer storm was on its way, coming to break the heat wave. After group, he stood beneath the awnings outside the community center and waited for the rain to ease. It was falling in fat, drenching sheets against the hot sidewalk, making the air feel electric. In the distance, he could hear the rumble of Milden, traffic, music, people. The world kept turning. When he lost the girls, that was one of the things that surprised him the most. That even after the tragedy he'd suffered, the world went on as it had before. People got up, had breakfast, drove to work, watched TV, celebrated birthdays, got drunk with their buddies and put their kids to bed. In those early days after the seizure, after the bridge, he resented people for it. Now he envied them. He watched Harold Dahlgren rush to his car, holding a newspaper above his head in lieu of an umbrella. When he finally made it to his little blue Civic, he saw Stan watching and waved. Thunder clapped overhead. Stan looked out at the storm and remembered.
Whoa, Lucy cried. That was a big one.
The biggest yet, Stan said.
It's getting close.
It was the night of the biggest storm to hit Milden in years. The power had gone out in the house, so Joanne had lit some candles and rolled out a picnic blanket on the upstairs landing beneath the picture window so they could watch the carnage roll into town. Heavy rain lashed the glass. Thunderheads rolled and cracked. Lightning lit the night sky blue. It was a year before the accident.
It sounds like it's right on top of us, Lucy said. She was buzzing with nervous energy.
Is it safe to sit by a window in a storm? Stan asked. What if a tree branch breaks off and blows through the glass?
Then your face will get shaved off, Joanne said.
It's fine. The glass is double glazed and stormproof.
Stormproof? Did you just make that up?
They exchanged a smile over Lucy's head. In the flickering candlelight, Joanne looked wild and beautiful. Thunder cracked again, loud and furious enough to rattle the walls of the house. Lucy, who was sitting between them, pressed her body closer to Stan's. She took off her mariner's cap, a rare sight to see, and set it down in her lap. She was as scared as she was excited. Stan pulled her in close and put his spare hand on Joanne's knee.
You know what your Aunt Claire and I called thunder growing up? Joanne asked.
God farts. Lucy promptly forgot about the storm and started rolling around on the picnic rug in a fit of laughter. She came close to kicking over both the candle and a bottle of red wine Joanne had brought up from the kitchen.
God farts, she said, giggling. God farts.
Believe it or not, there might have been a Roman god of flatulence, Joanne said. His name was Crepitus, but historians are pretty sure he was made up by Christians as a joke.
Is flatulence farting? Lucy asked.
Yep,
Stan said. Thunder rolled through the house again.
Oh no, Lucy said. Something stinks. Must be God's fart.
That cracked them all up.
Do you think the rain is God peeing? Lucy asked.
Sure is, Stan said. And hail is his boogers.
Lucy squealed at that and collapsed into another giggling fit. Laughing, Joanne took Stan's hand and squeezed it.
This is living, right? She said.
Outside, the storm raged on. Waiting for the rain to stop? Came a voice from behind him. It was the woman in the denim cutoffs. Out of the harsh yellow light of the community center, she looked pretty, with soft dark eyes and freckled skin. Stan nodded.
It's a decent walk to the bus station. Normally I don't mind, but I don't want to get soaked.
Stan hadn't driven since the accident.
Mind if I wait with you? She asked.
I'm Marcy.
Stan.
They shook hands. Despite the warm night, her skin was cold.
I liked what you said in there, she said.
Well, I didn't like it, but you know what I mean.
Do you always share like that?
Not always, he said. Sometimes it feels like whining, but mostly it helps. I'm sure it would help you too. No pressure.
She tilted her head and looked at him for a moment, confused. Then the penny dropped.
Oh, I'm not here because of, you know, grief. My dad died, but it was a long time ago.
So why are you here?
He asked. He expected her to tell him she was curious or that she was doing research for a novel or a screenplay. He wouldn't have been shocked if she'd told him she took some perverse pleasure in other people's misery. But what she said next was a surprise.
Actually, I'm here to see you.
Me? I'm sorry, do we know each other?
No, she said. An earnest crease appeared on her forehead as she tried to find the right words to say next. But in a way, I know your wife, Joanne. This is going to sound weird, but she sent me here.
My wife's been dead for 9 years, he told her.
Yeah, Marcy said. That's the weird part. A few years after Joanne died, Stan called a psychic hotline late one night. He saw the number advertised online. There was a beautiful woman in the ad, draped in layers of purple, promising intuitive insights into love and relationships, visions of the future, and the chance to talk to a lost loved one. It cost $4.99 per minute. After the pre-recorded intro message and a few minutes on hold listening to New Age harp sounds, he was connected to a woman who called herself Indigo. She didn't sound like an Indigo. She sounded like a Wendy or a Julie or a Kirsty or a Becky. Stan pictured a heavy woman in a middle American kitchen someplace, dressed in gray, chip-stained sweats, a cigarette in one hand, phone in the other.
"What's your name, hon?" she asked.
"Jack," he said, because he didn't want to give his real name.
"What made you pick up the phone tonight, Jack?"
"I lost some people," he told her. "Some important people, and I guess I want to know if they're still out there, and sorry, I've never done anything like this before. It's my first time."
"That's all right," Indigo said. "It sounds to me like you've gone through some shit, and now you're trying to make sense of something that seems senseless."
"Well, I'm here to tell you, Jack, it's not senseless at all. There's a plan in action that's bigger than us.
What happened, happened for a reason."
"I don't know if I believe that," he said. "No offense, but I don't know if I believe any of this."
"Part of you must, otherwise you wouldn't have called. Let me ask you this, Jack. If there ain't nothing after this life, what's the point of living it?"
Was that supposed to be comforting?
"How does this work?" he asked.
"Well, Jack, I'm what's called a medium. What I do is a little like placing a call to the other side. Now, I can't guarantee anyone will pick up, but I can tell you this. More often than not, there's someone home to take the call. All I need is the name of who you're trying to contact and a question to ask if I reach them." He'd spent most of the call pacing from one room to the next, but now he sat down on the bottom step of the staircase and whispered,
"Joanne."
"What do you want to ask her?"
I don't know. I just want to know that she's okay."
"That's it?" He thought it over.
"Ask her if she forgives me."
There were a few beats of silence on the other end of the line. Then, in a throaty whisper, Indigo said,
"Joanne. Yes, I'm getting something. I'm seeing kind eyes, wise eyes. I'm seeing a woman who was very special to you. I'm getting light-colored hair, gray or blonde."
"She had dark hair, but she dyed it blonde," he told her.
"A woman after my own heart," Indigo said. "I'm picking up something else now." "Her passing was sudden, wasn't it?"
"Yes."
"Very sudden."
"Yes."
"She wants you to know she loved you, Jack. She misses you as much as you miss her. But she's on the other side. She's happy. Joanne, I have Jack here. He's hurting. He misses you. He wants to know if you forgive him."
Indigo was quiet for a moment. Then,
"She's saying yes, Jack. She wants you to know that she forgives you. She wants me to tell you that a mother always forgives."
"A mother?"
For the record, Stan's mother was still alive and well, pottering away down in Boca Raton with his stepdad and 5-year-old corgi called Fargo. Indigo had taken a swing and missed.
"Joanne's not my mother," he said.
"Yes, she's telling me that now. She wants you to know it was just an expression. She's asking me to tell you—"
He hung up the phone, stung by how gullible he'd been. She had told Stan what she thought he wanted to hear. So when the woman in the denim cutoffs told him she'd been sent by his dead wife, he was skeptical.
"I'm not a psychic," Marcy blurted, loud enough to be heard above the rain thumping against the awnings. "That's not what this is, in case you're wondering. There's nothing special about me, but I have a daughter. She's the special one."
"Let me guess," Stan said. "She sees dead people."
She scoffed.
"Jeez, I must sound crazier than a soup sandwich."
"No, Erin's with her grandma, staying up way past her bedtime if I had to guess. She's not special like Whoopi Goldberg and Ghost or that kid who could see Bruce Willis. Erin doesn't see dead people."
"Looks like the rain is easing up," he said.
It wasn't, but it was time to go. Marcy tugged anxiously at her lip with her thumb and forefinger.
"Look, can we go someplace and talk? Just for a little while. I'll buy you coffee.
Talk about what exactly? He asked. She fixed him with a raw, desperate look and said,
How much do you know about reincarnation?
They went to a diner across the street from the community center. It was one of those all-night restaurants with bottomless coffees and paper menus. The air conditioning was working overtime, so the place was nice and cool. There were only a handful of customers, most of them eating alone at the front counter. A pretty waitress with corn-colored hair showed them to a quiet booth against a bank of windows that gave a view of the street outside. It was dark and wet. The rain wasn't going anywhere. They ordered coffee. If you had asked Stan why he indulged this woman when a sane person would have run the other way, he might have told you it would have been rude not to hear her out. He might have pointed out that this woman had tracked him down and it was smarter and safer to meet in public. He might have told you there was nothing at home for him but the clinking of cutlery. But all of those things would be a lie. He was there because he wanted to believe her. Sam was raised agnostic and had never belonged to any religion, but he'd always envied those who had faith to lean on when times were tough. People like Joanne's sister, Claire, had a pre-programmed, pre-packaged belief system loaded in the chamber and ready to fire. Stan had logic and reason. In the good old days, that was enough. But after the girls died, logic and reason felt like rocks in the pockets of a drowning man.
So, what makes you think my wife was reincarnated as your daughter? Stan asked, as matter-of-factly as he could manage.
Marcy turned pink. Okay, well, first up, Hindus and Buddhists believe in the transference of souls, and more people out here in the West are starting to believe it too. That's why we use expressions like old soul. The waitress came back with their coffee. Stan drank his black. Marcy took hers with 3 packs of Splenda.
A lot of people think we've lived dozens of lives before, she said. For the most part, people can't remember who they were before, but in some cases, kids can, when their minds are still young and fresh. I read about a girl online, somewhere in Italy, Bologna, I think. She claimed to remember being a man, growing old and passing away in a village nearby. The girl's parents took her to the village and she led them right to an apartment where a man had actually died 13 years earlier.
Marcy went on.
Then there was a boy from Idaho who claimed to have died on September 11th. His mother assumed he had an overactive imagination at first, but this kid knew what floor he was working on when the plane hit, the names of his 3 daughters, details about a childhood he never had, all of which were later validated. And on. There was a group of Burmese kids who claimed to have been Japanese soldiers who died in World War II in a previous life, and they knew stuff they shouldn't and couldn't know.
Are you saying your daughter knows things about my wife she couldn't?
An earnest little crease formed between Marcy's eyes. She remembers dying.
What did you say?
She remembers lying on the train yard beneath Prospect Bridge and dying. That's where your wife died, isn't it?
Over the years, Stan had tried hard not to think about what Joanne's final moments must have been like. But sometimes, usually late at night, sharp-toothed questions snuck into his head. Did she remain conscious all the way down? Did she regret her decision somewhere between the bridge and the rail yard?
Everyone knows Prospect is a suicide hotspot, Stan said. Your daughter might have heard it from one of her school friends or seen it on the news.
She was born the same night Joanne died.
I'm sure a lot of people died that night, and a lot of people were born.
You think it's a coincidence?
Stan shrugged.
Let's just say I'm yet to hear any evidence to the contrary.
The waitress came over to top up their coffees. When she was gone, Marcy tugged several napkins from the receptacle and started twisting them into nervous knots. The electronic chime above the door sounded as 4 teenagers entered the diner, laughing and shaking themselves off from the rain like wet dogs. Stan watched them for a second, wondering what they might think of the conversation he was having.
Aaron showed me where the accident happened, Marcy said.
What did you say?
She led me to a roadside memorial at the intersection of Weber and Tope Street. She says she remembers having a daughter, remembers Lucy, remembers what? Remembers what it felt like to lose her. A prickle of anger rose in Stan's gut. Mrs. Keefe, call me Marcy, she said. Marcy, I'm not exactly sure what you hope to gain from talking to me. You obviously know enough about my wife and daughter's deaths to track me down, but nothing you've told me proves anything. Marcy looked at him a little fearfully and said, I came here because I'm desperate, Mr. Weir. My little girl is suffering and I have to do something. If you would meet her, talk to her, we could figure out if this is real. He might have sat there and listened for a while more, might even entertain the idea of meeting the girl, but Marcy had stirred up old pain, and now it clung to him like a lamprey. Suddenly, he couldn't be there. Thanks for the coffee, he said, rising from the booth and heading for the door. Wait, Marcy said. She unfurled one of the napkins she'd ripped from the receptacle, wrote her number on it with a Bic she found in her purse, and passed it to him. Just in case you change your mind. I won't, he said. He didn't take her number. Instead, he left the diner and stepped out into the summer rain. Chapter 4. Marcy. It had seemed like a good idea to track down Stan Weir, but all Marcy had done was pick off old scabs. She'd seen it in his face. She'd hurt him. And now, as she watched Aaron lean back on one of Takashi Matsui's linen sofas, she felt sorry and desperate. She had hoped Stan might be able to help her daughter, but now they were on their own. What Aaron was going through wasn't a phase. It was real, at least to her, and Marcy finally felt ready to admit that. The lights in Matsui's office were dimmed to a warm, burnt orange. The curtains were drawn. From a small blue CD player in the corner drifted soft, tranquil music. A lonely piano, the gently gurgling of a stream, haunting bird calls.
Will this hurt? Aaron asked. The last time I went to the doctor, I got a shot. Mom said I wouldn't need one, but the doctor gave me one anyway.
It was a vaccination, honey, Marcy said. She was perched on the opposite sofa, arms crossed and nervous. To Matsui, as if it mattered, she added, for HPV. To Aaron, Matsui said,
This won't hurt a bit. It's nothing like getting a shot.
What will it feel like? She asked.
Like falling asleep in front of the TV, he said, when you can still hear the voices from the show you're watching, but you're not fully quite awake. Do you ever fall asleep in front of the TV?
Sometimes.
Me too. It drives Mrs. Matsui crazy. But there's nothing scary about it, right?
She shook her head.
I guess not. This music is weird, Aaron said.
Yes, I suppose it is. But it makes you feel calmer, right?
Uh-huh.
Matsui touched Marcy gently on the arm. The intimate gesture disarmed her. She looked up.
Can I have a quick word outside?
He asked. Sure. Aaron, I'll be right back, okay?
Okay,
she said. Matsui led Marcy to the door and out into the hall. Through the beaded curtain at the end of the corridor, she could see the receptionist behind her desk. She was on her phone, scrolling through Instagram. Quietly, Matsui said,
I'd like to record the session with your permission. You'll get a copy of the tape to take with you.
Of course.
There's one other thing.
Matsui hesitated, his bushy eyebrows furrowed.
I don't mind you being in the room, but I must ask that you stay quiet. At times, Aaron might appear distressed and vulnerable. She might cry or curse, but it's very important that you don't intervene. If you'd prefer to wait outside.
No, I'd like to be there.
He smiled. It did little to calm her nerves.
Ready?
He asked. She nodded. They went back into Matsui's office and closed the door. Aaron was lying still on the sofa, eyes open, listening to the CD. Matsui opened the top drawer of his desk and took out an old school tape recorder. He brought it over to Aaron, set it down on a small coffee table, and pressed the record button.
"We're ready to get started now, Aaron,"
he said.
"Okay. It's a little after 2 p.m. on August 3rd, 2020. The session is being recorded by me, Takashi Matsui, at the offices of Soul Potential, with the permission of Marcy Keefe, mother of Aaron Keefe, who will be regressing today."
Matsui's voice slowed. His tone became deep and soothing. Marcy thought he sounded stone.
"How are you feeling, Aaron?"
he asked. A pause. Then in a small voice, Aaron said,
"I feel okay."
"Good girl. Close your eyes."
She did.
"Now listen to my voice. Focus on it. Let it be all that you hear. We're going to concentrate on your breathing now. Breathe in. Breathe out. In. Out. That's it. Nice and easy. With every breath you take, you're feeling calmer, more relaxed. In, out. In, out."
From the low light, Marcy watched Aaron inhale and exhale, watched her small chest rise and fall.
"Think about your body,"
Matsui said, his voice steady.
"Think about the muscles in your face and neck. As you breathe out, those muscles relax. In, out. Your shoulders are relaxing now too. Your arms, your chest. In, out. Your stomach, your hips, your knees. All the tension in your body is slipping away. In, out. Your ankles, your feet, your toes. You've never been as quiet, as calm, as relaxed as you are right now."
Matsui was silent for a few beats while Aaron went on breathing.
"Now I want you to picture a door in your mind,"
he said.
"It can be any kind of door, but I want you to really see it, feel it, take notice of the details, what the door is made of, the shape of the handle. Can you see the door, Aaron?"
"Yes,"
she whispered.
"What kind of door is it?"
"It's like the front door of our apartment. Brown and wooden, with a little peephole in the front. Only the peephole is low enough so I can look through it."
"Perfect," Matsui said. "As I count down from 10, I want you to imagine you're reaching for the door handle, turning the handle, opening the door. When I reach 0, the door will open. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
10, 9, 8. You're reaching for the handle. 7, 6, 5, 4. You're turning it. 3, 2, 1. You're opening the door. 0. The door is open. Now step through the door, Aaron."
"Where does it go?"
"Into your own mind,"
he said.
"But there's no need to be afraid, remember? My voice travels with you wherever you go, and we're going to leave the door open so you can come back anytime."
"Okay," she said. "I'm stepping through."
"Good girl. On the other side of the door is a beach. The sand is white as snow. The sky is clear and blue. You can hear the water lapping gently against the shore. When you look to your left, you'll see that the coastline stretches on and on, way off into the distance. Can you see it?"
"Yes."
"That's your future, Aaron.
My future?
That's right, he said. Your future, unwritten and unexplored. Now I want you to turn to your right. You'll see a blanket of thick white mist, so dense you can hardly see the beach. Do you see it?
Yes.
That's your past. The mist is all your memories, not just from when you were little, but from before then. Walk into the mist, Aaron, into the past, into the life you lived before. Before you were Aaron.
I'm scared.
There's nothing that can hurt you in there. Now walk into the mist. Walk into the mist and tell me what you see.
I don't see anything.
Her tone grew anxious now.
Everything is just white. The fog is too thick. I can't even see my feet anymore.
But your feet are still there, Matsui assured her. Keep walking.
I think I see something. Up ahead, floating in the mist. I see...
What, Aaron? What do you see?
Eyes. Red eyes. There's something in here with me. It's watching me.
Aaron's breathing began to quicken.
There are more of them. They're everywhere, all around me. Red eyes, white eyes, yellow eyes. They're looking at me, watching me.
They can't hurt you, Aaron, Matsui said. Keep moving. Keep walking. Tell me what the eyes are doing now.
She drew in a tight, frightened breath.
One of them is winking at me. I can hear rain now, but I can't feel it. Wait. The mist is starting to go away. It's getting clearer. I see something.
What is it? What do you see?
The eyes. They're not eyes. They're lights. Red and white and yellow. They're cars. I'm looking down at cars through a big window. The glass is wet because it's raining, so all the lights outside are blurry.
Where are you?
I'm in a big building in the city, she said. I'm in a high up floor. Not all the way at the top, but close. The walls are the kind made of glass, so you can see all the way to the overpass. All the cars are taking people home. I want to go home, too.
Are you still Aaron? He asked.
No,
she whispered in a low, guttural tone. Marcy drew in a tight, sharp breath and held it.
Who are you?
A grown-up girl. Like Mom, but older.
What's your name?
There was a long pause before.
Jojo. My name is Jojo. My husband wants to know if I'll make it home for dinner. Eat without me, Stan.
Stan, is that your husband?
I'll just grab something from the vending machine or have an intern run out and get me something.
Marcy felt deeply unsettled. As far as she knew, Aaron didn't even know what an intern was. She looked unfamiliar in the dim orange glow. A strange little girl. A stranger.
Tell me about your husband, Jojo,
Matsui said. A slow grin crept over Aaron's face.
We met at college, she said. A dorm party. We talked about music and...
She giggled then, a sudden high-pitched girlish sound.
What's so funny? Matsui asked.
I played Stan a song on the guitar, she said. He didn't like it, but he pretended to because he liked me.
Tell me about Lucy, Matsui said.
Marcy had told him about their impromptu trip to the roadside memorial. Aaron's eyes shifted beneath their lids.
I don't want to talk about Lucy.
Why not?
It makes me sad.
Why does it make you sad?
She got pulled away.
Do you mean she passed away?
Matsui asked. A deep crease formed between Aaron's eyes. Gentle, quiet tears welled in her sockets. Then, in a slow, deep, eerie voice, she began to sing. It was a strange song about a caterpillar shedding its skin to become a butterfly. Marcy had never heard it before. Matsui swallowed an invisible obstruction in his throat, then gave Marcy a "this is fine" look. Aaron went on singing. It was a song about a caterpillar shedding its skin to become a butterfly. Marcy didn't recognize the song at first, but then it rushed back to her. She remembered driving home years earlier, Barb's Golden Oldies on the radio. She remembered Aaron singing along and wondering where on earth she'd learned the lyrics.
"What's that song?" Matsui asked.
"I used to sing that to Lucy when she was little," Aaron said. "She'd wiggle around, pretending to be the caterpillar, then spread her arms out like this when she became the butterfly."
Tears spilled down her cheeks. Her voice shuddered. Aaron's voice shuddered. Then after a beat of tragic silence, she said,
"He was supposed to protect her. He was supposed to take care of her. But he took her from me."
"Are you talking about your husband?"
"Stan, I love you," Aaron said. "But I hate you too."
Marcy had settled into a state of dark wonder. She lifted a hand to her face to discover she was crying too.
"Is that why you went to the bridge that night?"
Matsui asked. His tone was gentle. He was treading lightly.
"I don't want to talk about that," Aaron said.
"Please. It's important."
"I had to go," she said. "I didn't have a choice."
"Because you wanted to end things?"
Aaron breathed in and out. Without thought, Marcy's own breathing had matched her daughter's rhythm.
"I didn't want to end things," she said. "He did."
Marcy and Matsui both leaned forward at the same time, as if they'd rehearsed it.
"He told me if I didn't come to the bridge, he'd throw himself off."
Softly, Matsui said,
"I need you to listen very carefully, Jojo. Are you saying you weren't alone that night? Was there someone else there with you when you jumped from the bridge?"
"I didn't jump," Aaron said. "I was pushed."
Chapter 5. Stan. It was a small padded envelope. Stan took it from the mailbox gingerly. It had been a long time since anyone had sent him a package. He turned it over to read the sender. M. Keefe. This confirmed two things. One, this woman knew where he lived. And two, she wasn't going away. He squinted up at the sun. It was barely 10 a.m., but it was already hot. He took the envelope inside and poured himself a breakfast scotch. He drank it neat, in one steady gulp. He refilled the glass, added some ice and soda, and only then felt brave enough to open the package. He took a pair of scissors from the kitchen drawer and neatly snipped off the end of the envelope. Turning it over, he let its contents tumble into his hand. It was a cassette tape in a clear plastic case. Printed neatly on the label was Keefe, Aaron, past life regression. There was a single sheet of lined paper inside, ripped from a small notepad. Stan unfolded it and read, "Mr. Weir, there's something on this tape you should hear. If you want to talk, you can reach me on this number. Sincerely, Marcy Keefe." She'd written her telephone number at the bottom of the page. Stan read the note twice, finished his second whiskey of the morning, then headed down into the basement in search of something that would play Marcy's tape. It had been years since he'd seen a cassette, much less listened to one. He opened the basement door. Light from the hallway spilled down over the first few steps. Beyond that was darkness. Stan didn't like the basement. Every room of the house held memories, good and bad, but the basement had an unsettling sort of energy. He reached into the darkness and felt around for the light switch. Fluorescent tubes flickered on, lighting a vast space with a low ceiling. It was cluttered with cardboard boxes, photo albums, long-forgotten jigsaw puzzles, a dusty fold-out sofa, a desk with a bum leg, and the disassembled pieces of Lucy's old crib. He knew his only Sony Walkman was down there somewhere, buried under all that miscellaneous stuff. He started searching boxes, sifting through ancient electronic equipment, extension cords, cables, and batteries. He noticed the sledgehammer against the far wall, right where he'd left it last time he'd been down there. People say there are 5 stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Even after all these years, Stan could still experience all 5 in a single day. But there was a dark period of time in the months after the girls died that could accurately be described as stage 2. He got angry in a way he'd never experienced before, and for a long time he didn't know what to do with all that rage. He held it in and let it fester, like rot in the walls of an old house, until he figured out a way to bring it down here, to the basement. Late one night during stage 2, he came downstairs to thumb through old photo albums and cry. That's when he discovered the sledgehammer. It was resting on a pile of old tools that had been abandoned by the previous owner of the house. He got the strange sense the hammer had been waiting for him. It was heavy. It felt good to shift the weight from one hand to the other, to work the handle between his palms. Almost without thinking, as if his arms were acting on their own, he had lifted the sledgehammer over his head and brought it down hard against the wall. Afterward, he'd felt relieved. The ringing, satisfying thud of hammer against wall temporarily blocked out the drumbeat of rage that had pulsed in his head. He stepped back to examine the hole he'd made, to admire it. Then he made another one, and another one. Soon the air had been filled with plaster dust. The force of each strike vibrated up his arms and into his shoulders. It was satisfying. He had felt purged. He punched 13 holes in the wall that night before he exhausted himself. When he was done, he dropped the hammer, lay down beside it on the floor, and slept like a baby. Over the next few days, he'd hung fresh drywall. He watched a tutorial online and wallpapered it with a yellow, flowery design. The next time he reached bursting point, he smashed up the wall again. This continued over and over. He'd break down the wall, hang a new one, and repeat. A pile of rubble and broken drywall grew in the corner of the room. The only thing that changed was the wallpaper. It was cathartic. There was something cyclical about it. First, he destroyed something. Then, he rebuilt it. Or was it the other way around? He thought. He found the Walkman wedged between a rusty Nintendo Game Boy and a stack of old VHS tapes in a box marked "For Charity." On his way back upstairs, he paused on the top step to look back at the sledgehammer. It was waiting for him, if he needed it. Then he switched off the light and shut the basement door firmly behind him. He sat down in the living room. He took the batteries out of the TV remote and put them in the Walkman. He removed the last tape he'd listened to, Radiohead's Pablo Honey, and put the headphones on. He then took a long, deep breath and hit the play button. "It's so good to hear your voice, Stan," Claire said. "Gosh, how long's it been?"
"Too long," Stan admitted.
The last time he'd seen Joanne's sister was Christmas Eve the previous year. She and Max had dropped by the house with an indoor fern wrapped in a bow and invited him to Christmas dinner. Stan had politely declined and instead spent the 25th drinking eggnog alone. Claire had made him promise to call, but he hadn't picked up the phone until now.
"How are the kids?" he asked.
Claire and Max had twins now, a boy and a girl. "They're keeping me on my toes, that's for sure," she said. "Their 7th birthday's coming up. It's all they can talk about. Flo wants a motorized bike, Billy wants a Nintendo something or other, and Max thinks we'll need to take out a second mortgage on the house to pay for it all."
The world keeps turning, Stan thought.
It was close to 11 p.m. He was sitting in his darkened living room, phone in one hand, scotch in the other. Ice clinked inside the glass. The Walkman lay in pieces against the far wall, right where he'd thrown it when reaching the end of Aaron Keefe's regression tape.
I didn't jump, Aaron's voice whispered in his head. I was pushed.
You should come and see them, Stan, Claire said. They're getting so big. If they keep growing at this rate, we'll have a couple of basketball players on our hands.
Send them my love, he said.
Why don't you bring it to them yourself? Come down to the house this week. We'll do a dinner just like the old days. Max and the kids would love to see you, and you're still family, Stan.
Thanks, Claire, he said. Maybe I will.
She laughed. Well, I'll keep inviting you over, and you'll keep saying maybe, but one of these days, I'm actually going to make it happen. Now, to what do I owe this pleasure? She asked.
I have sort of a left field question, he said. Do you remember anyone ever calling Joanne JoJo?
Joanne and Stan had never used pet names for one another. There was plenty of honey, darling, even the occasional babe, but never JoJo. Still, it had sounded vaguely familiar when he heard it on the tape.
JoJo, Claire echoed, clicking her tongue. Gosh, I haven't heard that in years. Mom called us pet names when we were kids. I was Claire Bear, Joanne was JoJo. Talk about a blast from the past. How did you know about that?
It was a good question. A better one was, how did Aaron Keefe know about that? Stan sipped his scotch and said,
Claire, do you ever wonder what happened to them after they died?
Stan pictured Claire's warm, round face, forehead etched with concern for her sister's widower.
No, because I don't need to wonder. Jesus said, my father's house has many rooms. Joanne and Lucy are in heaven, Stan, together with God. Are you all right, Stan?
Yeah, it's been a weird night, that's all. A woman approached me at a support group.
You go to a support group? She asked.
I started going a few months ago.
That's good, Claire said. Support networks are important. Now, tell me about this woman. Is she single?
It's not like that, he said. Her name's Marcy. She came to me because her daughter's been having problems. She's 9.
What kind of problems?
She's been remembering things that didn't happen to her.
I don't understand.
How could you help? One of the things she remembers is dying on Prospect Bridge, he told her. Claire, this little girl believes, for whatever reason, that she is the reincarnation of Joanne's spirit.
A pregnant pause on the other end of the line, then, that's insane.
More insane than God having a house with many rooms? Stan wondered.
But that didn't make him feel any less stupid. He wondered, and not for the first time, if he was having some sort of mental breakdown.
Did this woman ask you for money? Claire asked. There are a lot of cruel people in this world who'll take advantage of other people suffering.
She must have an angle, Stan. You said you met her at your support group. That's probably where she finds her targets.
It's not like that, he said.
Oh, Stan, you don't actually believe this, do you?
No, he said. But this little girl knows things she shouldn't and couldn't know.
Like what?
For one thing, she knew the name JoJo. She knew Joanne worked in a big building with a view of the overpass. She knew my name, how we met. She knew about Lucy, and
he needed a deep, steadying breath before he could finish the sentence.
And how she died.
I hate to play devil's advocate, Claire said, but if this is some sort of scam, all of those details could be dug up online, or maybe she heard you talking about them in your support group. That's how these people operate.
There's something else. The girl knew a song, There is a Mountain, by Donovan. It was one of Joanne's favorites.
He thought back to the morning after Joanne left, remembering the record loaded on the turntable in Lucy's room, Donovan's greatest hits.
Joanne used to sing it to Lucy when she was little.
Stan was sure he hadn't mentioned Lucy's groovy dance moves at his support group, because he hadn't remembered them himself until the tape reminded him. Now the memory played on repeat in his head like a flickering home movie. Lucy, a chubby 3-year-old, wriggling and wiggling like a caterpillar, stretching her arms out when she became the butterfly, and then collapsing into a giggling fit on the floor. He was also sure that nobody could have found that information online. Joanne used social media, but she was fiercely private about it and didn't share more than the occasional cute animal video or inspirational quote.
"None of this is proof of anything, Stan," Claire said. "I don't mean to be a stick in the mud. I just don't want to see you get hurt."
She was right. The tape wasn't proof. Marcy Keefe had come to him with cupped hands and told him there was a treasure inside, and he was yet to see it with his own eyes. But he was ready to look.
"Did she say anything else?"
Claire asked.
"I didn't jump," Aaron whispered in his head. "I was pushed."
And there was the rub. To believe Aaron Keefe now was to believe his wife was pushed, killed, murdered. If this was a con, it was a cruel one. Marcy Keefe and that damn tape had stirred up a lot of old pain and fresh confusion. But it had also given Stan a gift, the possibility of innocence. If someone else killed Joanne, it shifted the blame away from Stan. So in a macabre sort of way, the idea of her being pushed to her death by a monster was appealing. It was also something he'd considered before. In the early weeks after Joanne's death, as Stan inched his way through stage one, denial, he couldn't accept the way she had died. Suicide just wasn't her. She had no history of depression or mental illness, and even after the trauma of Lucy's death, her actions seemed too extreme, too total, too final. So he created a serial killer in his mind, mid-30s, white male, handsome enough to trust, but not handsome enough to be remembered. He went from city to city, state to state, stalking popular suicide hotspots. When an unsuspecting pedestrian got close enough to the railings, or an unsuspecting hiker got too close to a cliff edge, he'd shove them over it. It was close to the perfect murder. Stan had even invented a name for the man, the suicide killer. It was the part of Aaron's story he desperately wanted to believe, but it was also the most unlikely. If anyone had pushed his wife off that bridge, it was him.
"No," he said. "She didn't say anything else. Sorry, Claire, I know it's late. I'll let you go."
Claire must have had more questions, but she didn't ask them. Instead, she said quietly,
"I'm worried about you, Stan." "You don't need to be."
"Can I set you a place for Sunday dinner?"
"Maybe," Stan said.
"Maybe it is," Claire told him. "Good night." That night, Stan fell asleep long after midnight and dreamed that Joanne and Lucy came home. They strolled through the front gate and up the front steps. Joanne reached for the door, but it was locked. Lucy stepped forward and gave the handle a jiggle herself. Nothing. Mother and daughter exchanged a long, mournful glance, then walked away. Stan observed all this from some third-person dream place. He watched them fade into layer upon layer of darkness. He tried to call out to them, but his mouth was full of something dry and bitter.